Thank you. There's an advantage to being the last speaker. I don't have to stay for 25 minutes, right? I can talk longer. It's been a long afternoon, so I want everybody to stand up because I was getting really tired. And Jim Nienhuis will lead us in jumping jacks. Okay, good. That's what I expected. Okay. Well, I stretch, do whatever, you know. Move your arms around. You people with Fitbits.
How many people have Fitbits? If you do this, you get steps.
I don't know about stairs, though. My wife drives me crazy. She calls it her little precious. Anyways, thank you. I want to thank the organizers for inviting me. This is a project that's been dear to my heart for about 10 years, and I really enjoy talking about it. So what I'll be talking about today is a project that's been supported by the Horticulture Innovation Lab since about 2009 in various projects. The team is listed here. Jim Simon from Rutgers. You've heard Rutgers before. Jim Simon is the lead PI on this project. He graciously told me I could come to Hawaii and he would stay at home doing the work at Rutgers. But you can see we have nutritionists, economists, graduate students, and really good collaborators from Zambia, Kenya, and Tanzania. And before I forget, I would really like to thank UC Davis and John Bowman and USAID because without them and the support they provide, this project would not be possible, and they really helped facilitate a lot of our work, not only within the countries, but also when we communicate with the mission people, which sometimes any of you that have worked with the mission people know you need help sometimes. So thank you very much. So this was mentioned in a couple of the earlier talks, but the projected population growth between now and 2015, it changes a little bit from time to time, as you saw. Estimates now are close to 10 billion again by 2050, but you can see that low-income countries are going to increase populations quite dramatically compared with the high-income world. And this is especially true in sub-Saharan Africa, where estimates are 134% increase in population in the next 40 years. Latin America, Caribbean, about 25%, and North Africa and West Asia, about 61%. These are important issues in agriculture because many of the countries within these regions are highly agricultural, economic based. There's high levels of poverty, and there's high levels of nutritional problems. And those are all issues that we hope to be able to address. So in sub-Saharan Africa, in case studies from Kenya and Zambia where we work, we know that sub-Saharan Africa has begun to make some nutritional transitions, as John talked about. There's been some very dramatic improvement recently. But the efforts to reduce these nutritional problems must focus on reducing not only undernutrition, but also to guard against some of the introduction of our Western diet, which leads to, as was mentioned earlier, obesity is a problem in sub-Saharan Africa in certain spots. We want to have interventions that avoid that. We also have to consider the economic advances and integrated approaches that we use in our agricultural interventions to improve household economics and improve nutrition. Our project also, as I'll mention later, has a lot of interventions related to education, not only the general household, but especially for the women, because they are very important in not only determining what the family eats, but contrary to what some people think, they also have a lot of power in certain instances over how that money within the household is spent. So if we can convince them to spend it on school fees and nutrition, we can improve that, especially for young women and young children. So especially women of childbearing ages. And we are aiming to have interventions that promote consumption of nutrient-rich foods. And our nutrient-rich foods are the indigenous vegetables. And these vegetables often aren't on the list of nutrient-dense foods from FAO and USDA. So we're hoping some of the research that we generate with our nutritional information will get these on those lists. Why focus on indigenous vegetables? We call them AIVs, some people, African indigenous vegetables. Some people call them African leafy vegetables. Same thing, really. But they are foods that can help us address these undernutrition problems. They have been a mainstay to differing degrees in traditional diets for many, many years. Some people call them poor people's food. Some people call them famine foods because a lot of them would be considered weeds in the United States. But when people need food, they eat things that are available. So these have been consumed in various degrees over time. There's over 400 species in sub-Saharan Africa that are thought to fit within these categories. In the past, they haven't been cash crops, but with the movement of a lot of populations to the city, when people first moved to the city, they consider these poor people's food. They don't want to eat it. Well, the longer they're there, they miss them. So that market has great potential, not only in the cities, but also in the rural areas. It's been mentioned, Kate mentioned it, but the availability of these vegetables is high during the rainy season, but low during the dry season and moderate during the short rain season that we run into. That's why we were interested in Kate's research in irrigation, where we can provide a supply of these vegetables throughout the year and create a better income flow for our farmers. We know that there's a lot of literature about the nutritional aspects of these AIVs. We want to prove that with our studies and the experiments we do. And so we think there's a natural bridge in linking agriculture, production of AIVs, and improved nutrition and health within our target countries. So the goal of our program is not only to improve production and increase consumption of AIVs so that we have better nutrition, better income, improved health at these at-risk populations in Kenya, Zambia, and Tanzania. And hopefully this will expand out to other parts of Africa. And we're building our program on previous studies showing that there's a significant interest and acceptance of AIVs by rural farmers if we show them that there's a linkage to markets, a linkage to income, and a linkage to nutritional improvement. We know we heard staple crops. In Kenya, maize, and more maize. It's not very diverse. And we use what we consider, Rutgers likes to call it, their model of market first and science-driven development to reach our objectives. A lot of people use it. I don't think it's just Rutgers. So our challenges, we need to have greater understanding as to what the best interventions are, both in production and consumption. We have to provide information that provides both rural and peri-urban households with greater access and affordability of AIVs. I mentioned the dry season thing. We need to strengthen these value chains for not only market, but also inputs. These farmers tend to be resource poor in many cases, and so access to good seed, et cetera, which I'll talk a little bit more about, is often difficult. So I'll get into this a little more, but our project findings thus far indicate that in our targeted areas that AIVs are well known by people that we surveyed, with greater than 90% of the populations viewed them as foods that they were aware of. And in some cases, they were a preferred food. We think this translates into a really untapped market if we can increase this production and increase nutritional information to these consumers. So we look at it as the four A's: access, affordability, availability, and adoption. Access, access to good production inputs, land, as was mentioned by Kate, access to the AAVs themselves, not only by the farmers, but by the consumers. Affordability. You introduce technology, it's not affordable, they're not going to use it. So we have to have affordable inputs and affordable food. And we have to make sure that this food is available and that these inputs are available. And adoption. Once you have these first three A's, then you would hopefully provide a pathway for adoption by the farmers, adoption by the consumers, leading to not only greater income, but measurable health improvements. And then we have the technical factors, the financial factors, the household dynamics, and the biological and cultural factors. And a lot of these have been talked about before. The technical factors are just the production, the processing, the value addition. The financial factors, do you have the finances to be able to afford the things that we've talked about? Household dynamics, gender is front and center in these studies. You've probably heard this before, but vegetable crops worldwide are called thought of as women's crops. And the men, and I know this from Kenny and my experience there, they don't get interested in them until they find out there's money to be made. But the women still grow them, the men just take the money many times. And then biological and cultural factors, the age of the population, and especially the younger children and the women. So when we did our studies, we saw the frequency of AIV consumption. This is from Zambia, but it was similar in Kenya. And you can see the list of the various vegetables that we ask about. And I'll start over with the everyday. You can see that very few of people consumed any of these vegetables every day. Sometimes this would be once to two times a week. You see that the percentage went up a bit. Amaranth, nightshade, spider plant, jute mallow, that we are some of the Ethiopian mustards, African eggplant, other AIVs. They're fairly commonly consumed, but not every day. And then you can see rarely, once a month, maybe the percentages are quite high for many of them also. So again, this is an opportunity. So I'm going to go through the objectives of our project. The first objective with the hypothesis was that appropriate interventions can increase access to and consumption of AIVs among producers and consumers in Kenya. You can read the blue thing if you want, but that basically says that we looked at past data and analyzed it to figure out how some of our surveys should be conducted. So we did a pilot survey on a small subsample of people. We found out that AIVs are very popular, but not generally consumed regularly. We found that Kenyans and Zambians would opt to consume AIVs, but don't due to, as I mentioned, access, affordability, availability. And many, which also is an opportunity for us, had no idea how nutritionally valuable they are to good health. And so these results help drive us. So our first lesson, developing and identifying effective intervention methods, will help lead us to access, affordability, availability, and adoption. But we had to do larger surveys to get even a better idea. We found out the WDD, Women's Dietary Diversity, is very low. Another opportunity for us to increase women's nutritional diversity and health, which is a major target for us. We followed these preliminary surveys, consumer surveys, to compare various aspects of production and nutrition education. We looked at 500 households with at least one woman of childbearing age and at least one child in both Kenya and Zambia. So we had 1,000 people in those two countries in 2016 to evaluate some of these baseline production and consumption intervention activities that we hope to have planned. So our approach in each Kenya and Zambia will be to take 125 households that we will provide them with nutritional education intervention activities, but no production. The second group will be production intervention activities, but no nutrition. Both types of interventions, where we have both production and nutritional interventions, and a control group where we have no interventions. And so after we have these interventions and follow up, we will then have a survey at the end of the project to see how these interventions actually allowed us to affect the various groups' approaches to both production, consumption, or not. This is just a map of Kenya and Zambia. You can see here two sites in Zambia in eastern, more northern, central Zambia, and then down around Lusaka. And in Kenya, it's mainly in the western area from Eldoret over to the Uganda border and a little bit south towards Tanzania. Lesson two, the survey showed us that 98% of our producers want access to better production practices, technology, and pest management in the production aspects. So our action plan, we'll have discrete activities to promote AIV cultivation and access to markets, both in the informal and the formal market, to increase the availability of AIVs in our target communities throughout the year. And our nutritional program will be just a little bit different. We'll evaluate if learning about the nutritional and health benefits of AIVs does in fact result in increased consumption. We're also targeting non-producers, more of the urban, peri-urban people that don't produce these, so that they will hopefully consume more of the AIVs. We'll also possibly there'll be some counter stimulation from the producers. Maybe some of them will start producing AIVs, and I'll talk a little bit about some of our approaches in the peri-urban and urban areas on how they might produce AIVs. And this will allow us to determine changes in AIV consumption and dietary quality between communities that participate in the various interventions. And hopefully we'll have a change in attitude. So nutritional education intervention, BCC, that stands for behavioral change conversations or interventions. So these individuals will be given nutrition content of AIVs, recommendations on intake amount, why it's healthy, and we also will have recipes and meal preparation training. And you can see that little colorful diagram there, what's on your plate, let's eat them, why, and let's have some delicious recipes. I was a kid once, I hated vegetables. Let's make them taste good. But let's not put sugar in them, okay. Lesson four, everybody in the surveys were excited when we mentioned AIVs and how important they could be, and hopefully this will have a big effect on our interventions. The second objective was appropriate promotion and expansion of AIVs will strengthen market access. So we surveyed 300 AIV producers and 75 intermediate marketers to identify what some of the bottlenecks and productivity to help guide some of our interventions. The lesson here, growers report that the AIVs don't really require any more input than some of the traditional vegetables that they grow, like cabbage and tomatoes. But they do report difficulties in access to a lot of the important inputs, and I'll show you some diagrams of that. As far as the marketers and the consumers, they were willing to pay more if the AIVs were organically produced. Some if they taste good, some if they were convinced they were healthy, and others if they knew that the vegetables were grown under good phytosanitary conditions. And you can see here some of the thoughts for sweet potato, cowpea, spider plant, nightshade, and amaranth, opportunity to earn extra income, maybe more availability for home consumption. Maybe they would grow them more if they had production experience. And of course, farmers are always looking for good prices. As far as where do they get their seed, this is a real challenge for us. They don't have access to good quality seed. They try to save their own seed. They don't do a good job of saving it. They harvest it when it's not mature. They don't store it right. This goes back to we're doing seed training of the farmers. We're doing it also with the beads that Beth talked about so that they're stored properly and they're high quality when they're planted. But that's a big problem. Where do they trade? Well, the majority of them directly to consumers. Some use, about 18% use wholesalers, but you can see supermarkets. If you ever heard Reardon from Michigan State talk, supermarkets are taking over the world, even in the developing world. Well, you go to the supermarkets in these countries and the AIVs basically are terrible. We have a real opportunity. Oh, they're wilted. And when we go and talk to them, they say, oh, we get them somewhere from Nairobi. This is an opportunity for us. And the constraints, you can see here, seeds are the big one, but we have fertilizer, land preparation, a few pests and diseases, and credit and financial availability. So our AIV and objective three is to introduce better cultural practices, better management technologies, improved seed, integrated pest management, and irrigation and drought tolerance. So our lesson here, 91% of our producers want better AIV seed quality. Lesson six, 75% of the farmers want training for production during the dry season and drought. And this is critical. And then to the evaluation of the nutrient composition. I'll just start here because I know I'm probably running out of time, right? Many of the AIVs are very nutrient rich, and we hope that once we can get good hard data on this, we'll submit them to USDA for inclusion in nutrient rich vegetable listings. I'll talk about the spider plant later, but spider plant, any of you that know about it, it flowers quickly, and harvest usually only takes place for about a month after it reaches the point of harvestability. We've done some selections, and we have spider plants now that are much longer in their production period. So this is going to allow many growers who avoid growing this because of this one-month harvest to grow it longer period of time. And there are certain parts, in Kenya especially, where the consumers will not buy nightshade if spider plant isn't available because they eat the two of them together. So this could be very important for what we do. So our lesson seven, selection and breeding for micronutrients is possible. We've done some work with Amaranth, a graduate student at Rutgers, who has shown we have selected for a high iron-containing amaranth. Most amaranths are fairly low in it. And so that's also important, and we're looking at other possibilities there. We're basically using improved seed lines from World Veg Center in Tanzania for our base things. As far as amaranth nutritional performance, we tested our amaranths in the U.S. We tested them in Tanzania. We tested them throughout the season. And regardless of the genotypes we looked at or the time of year we grew it, they all tended to be very high in calcium and magnesium in all environments. Zinc was below source in all genotypes and environment. And as I mentioned, the iron high source was in one type. Most of them were below source, but it depended on the genotype. But we do have a genotype that we're developing for that. As far as field performance, amaranth I use as an example, but we've done it with spider plant nightshade. We're also looking at jute mallow throughout the season for performance. We do not want to introduce a genotype that does not grow well in the environment we introduce it into, has good yield, and has good acceptability to the sellers and the consumers. So that's a primary aspect that we're looking at in all of these field evaluations. This is a follow-up on the amaranth. All of the varieties we looked at had reasonable to very high levels of calcium and magnesium. So genotype, it wasn't specific there, but the one iron type is the one that was very important there. And we're actually looking at being able to provide these seeds for the market in the next year or two. This is some of the nutrient analysis. Amaranth, very high in beta carotene, a precursor to vitamin A, and also very high in polyphenols. And we compared that with spinach, and it looked very good in most cases there. Spider plant, vitamin E was quite high, and also beta carotene, another precursor of provitamin A. So that looked very good to us. And then nightshade was high in vitamin E, and again in beta carotene, in all the accessions we looked at. Now, one of the things that any of you that ever talk to Americans about eating nightshade, they all say, you can't eat that. That's poison. It'll kill you. Well, deadly nightshade will. But it's the same family, but it's a different genus and species. So we wanted to look at these nightshade accessions for the presence of alkaloids and anti-nutrient properties. All of our nightshades in the leaves, very low to no levels of alkaloids. And so that looked good. Now, when we look at the fruits, they're high. But we don't eat the fruits in these parts of the world. We eat the leaves. So it looks very good. And so we're happy to see that. And you can see in the case of the mature fruits, I know you can't see it, I'll tell you, because there's too much damn data up there, but high alkaloids in the fruits. A couple of interesting things. Diastgenin, you know what that is? That was a precursor for birth control pills, and it was isolated from a Mexican yam. So a lot of these alkaloids are very bioactive, maybe sometimes good, many times bad. We want to avoid that because we're looking for a healthy diet. And just a side note, Jim Simon's very interested in moringa. Moringa grows very well in sub-Saharan Africa. It grows very well on droughty soils and soils that are low in nutrients. But you can see it's very high nutritionally for iron, magnesium, calcium, zinc, and many of the other nutrients. And so this is something that we're hoping for. I'm almost done. So we want to talk a little bit. We say science-driven. We're trying to publish our papers as much as we can. This is what's really rewarding about this international work. You not only work with good scientists in the U.S., but you work with really great people and scientists in the developing world, graduate students, scientists in the universities there, and we're publishing as much as we can to help them and to help us, too, and build the capacity of the scientists, not just the farmers. And the peri-urban, urban schools, one of the neat things we're doing, there's a Tumani Center for Street Boys as part of AMPATH in Kenya. And we've been having interventions with these boys to teach them about growing AIVs. They're on a farm there, they're growing a lot of things. They don't have a lot of good training on the farm, so we're providing training with AIVs and other vegetables and innovative technologies like sack gardens. And these sack gardens could actually be grown, used in urban areas where people don't have a lot of land but want to grow some vegetables for their home consumption. And the other objective is we want to hopefully train some of these young people to be farmers. We don't want them all to move to the city. We want young people to become farmers. And because in Kenya, the average age of the farmer tends to be fairly high, just like in the U.S. So if we can introduce more people to this and show them that they can make money, have a good livelihood, and also have a little bit of free time once in a while, we want to do that. And there's some of the training pictures that we have. And I think you're telling me I'm done. Yeah. Challenges, you can quickly look at that. I've already talked about them. We're addressing these challenges. We're targeting our interventions based on these challenges, and so we can enhance accessibility, the four A's. And our lessons learned, I think we talked about those lessons learned. And so I'll stop there. And thank you very much for your attention. And these are the people that work. They do all the work. I give the talks once in a while. And I just add one other side. My wife said to me this morning, "You seem very nervous about this talk, Steve." And I said, "I am. It's the first talk I've given since I retired." And you know, when you're retired, nobody listens to you anymore, right? Thank you.
We're going to take questions at the panel. So first of all, I would like to thank Dr. Beth Mitchell for leading this UC Davis Innovation Lab, and I think she made a big impact on the global level. So, and let us give a big hand to Beth Mitchell. So also Dr. John Bowman for funding this project. We appreciate all your help in making the impact on the world level. So what we are going to do is now, we had a lot of questions in between the speakers, so we'd like the speakers to come in the front. If you can pull your chairs also, that would be great. So then we'll ask some questions. And first of all, I would like to give a lot of chance to the audience. If you can start thinking about questions and challenges of what you heard so far at the global level about this topic, about the developing countries, food security and nutritional level. So while we're setting up, you can just start thinking about the questions. Then we'll put some speakers on the spot, a little bit of some of those questions.
Yeah, so just to refresh your memory, right? We started off with a great overview about food security and some of the issues with obesity and hunger and malnutrition. And then we heard from John Bowman about the importance of horticulture and the role it can play in food security at USAID and beyond. Then we heard about some innovative technologies from Angelus Delstedis at Horticulture Innovation Lab, the chimney dryer, the Coolbot coal room, and the floating gardens. Then we went on to Gurbinder Gill, who talked about some of the post-harvest capacity building that they're doing in Rwanda and Burkina Faso, and the entrepreneurship and the business development. Then we heard about pest exclusion nets and trying to scale those in Kenya. We went on to talk about irrigation systems and participatory project development in Uganda with Kate Scow. And then finally, we ended with the African Indigenous Vegetables presentation from Steve Weller from Purdue. So just to, hopefully most of you were here for some of that, or if you weren't, you can ask questions about any of those topics for any of our speakers. And I guess for the speakers, when someone asks you a question or you want to make a comment, please come over to the podium, use the microphone, and repeat the question because we're still being recorded here. Thank you.
I think when John Bowman talked, he mentioned some of these horticultural projects that were going on in other parts of the world. But I know from my own personal experience in the past, I was on the IPM CRIS back years ago, and that was all based on what they called non-traditional ag export crops, which are basically fruits and vegetables that are exported and imported into the U.S. But last year we had our annual meeting in Guatemala, And there are some very exciting programs going on down there in Guatemala with various fruits and vegetables, which Beth can probably address better than I can, but there's very active programs there and very active programs in Southeast Asia, Bangladesh, as part of the Horticulture Innovation Lab. So we're covering, I think, how many of the Feed the Future countries are you in, Beth? 15 of how many are there, John?
19.
So,
but now there's 12.
So I think these issues are being addressed. And one thing I'll say is the other thing that's always been impressed upon the people that are funded by USAID in what used to be called the CRISPs and now called the Innovation Labs, intra and inter innovation labbing. And for, I didn't get a chance to say it because I had way too many slides, but in our project, we're using the solar dryer, we're using the CoolBot in certain instances, we're using the seed dry bead technologies. We're getting ready to work with the netting project because we have a lot of pest problems, especially birds, in our AIVs when they're first coming up. And also with Kate and her irrigation, because if we don't use those types of technologies that are affordable, we don't accomplish our goal of year-round accessibility. I don't know. You should say something, Beth, because you know a heck of a lot more about it than I do, what's going on in other places. But this is a great project.
Sorry, I'd kind of missed the question because I was getting set up here, so Steve filled me in. Yeah, the Horticulture Innovation Lab is quite active in Central America. We have some really interesting projects in Honduras. Jim Neen, who's sitting here in the front, is working on tomato grafting in Honduras and also Guatemala, which is a very has been very successful and very important tool. We have the gender project in Honduras that John talked about that's looking at kind of the constraints and opportunities for women in horticulture in Central America, particularly Honduras. And then we have a number of really exciting projects in Southeast Asia. The thing that's interesting, though, is that I think no matter most of our projects, no matter where they are, they're developing information that's useful across the spectrum around the world. I mean, obviously, things have to be dialed in for the specific location, but generally, and as Steve alluded to, you know, the technologies that our researchers work on, they get picked up by other researchers in our team, and we're hoping also they get picked up by other people, and that's why we like to share them at venues like this, because they can be useful in a wide variety of locations with just a little bit of adaptation.
One thing that I want to add, the solar dryer, the little solar dryer that Davis developed, and we introduced it to Mace Foods. You saw a picture of Mace Foods, I think, in John's presentation. They dry indigenous vegetables, and they sell them in Europe, and they sell some in the U.S. But they saw this, and they also, their biggest project is African chili peppers, and the farmers grow it and they dry them on the ground, essentially. Not very sanitary and everything. They saw this dryer and they built a bunch of them and gave them to their farmers. So that was technology transferred serendipity, I guess, because they saw the potential of it. So I think this is being observed by not just farmers and marketers, but private sector. Because you're the one that made us build one.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah,
we should address this question.
Yeah, let me let John comment, and then we'll get to your question in just a second. Go ahead.
But I think you were asking particularly why aren't we in like Andean South America? Wasn't that your question, right? You guys know this. Well, first of all, totally kicked out of Bolivia, Venezuela. It's not really It's in turmoil right now, and agriculture's not the top priority. Colombia, there's still, I think, an agricultural priorities there, but it's not in the Feed the Future initiative. But I believe there's still going on. Typically in these Andean countries, you have efforts to grow crops that provide an alternative income against coca. That's been going on for years, and apparently it's still a priority. But the decision to work on agriculture in, let's say, Andean countries, Peru, since they're not in the Feed the Future initiative, it's totally determined by, mission, the field office. The field office decides what they're going to work on. Are you going to work on coffee or are you going to work on maize? I mean, they make these decisions for a variety of reasons. And sometimes they choose to totally exit from agriculture altogether for a number of reasons. For example, in the last couple of years, we had pretty robust programs in Indonesia in agriculture. Indonesia, in terms of it's way beyond rice. I mean, they're looking at, there's a lot of crops and fruits and vegetable production is booming, but, the mission, somebody came in, took over the mission, and essentially did a huge downsizing because he felt that it was much more important to focus on health and the environment. And most of the agricultural projects that were present were just way too small for his liking. So he wanted everything, thrown out that was, under $20, $30 million kind of projects. He didn't want a lot of small projects. So a lot of times these decisions on what is worked on in these countries is determined by the mission directors, who are in close touch with the ambassador, and then there's all the politics of what does the host country want and what does the U.S. government want. So Feed the Future now, for the past months, we've been making important decisions on and finally released these 12 countries, and it was no small task. It was like working group after working group, determining, whether or not Cambodia stays or Cambodia does not stay as a focus country. It's out. Tanzania is out. Zambia is out. All kinds of reasons for this that I can't really go into, but in terms of the research community, I will make one statement, and that is we have kind of some flexible license to work kind of where we want. We have some license to work in countries beyond these 12 that are right now kind of put forward, because what they want out of the research team in the next 5 years is they want more kind of global public good to come out of the science and the research that we do. So we have some kind of, multi-million dollar project on horticulture or on climate resilient beans or something like that. They want now our work not to be just servicing one particular country, one particular field office that really wants that work. They want our work to have impact across a wide variety of countries. So it's going to make it a little bit more difficult for us. But if we can prove that, if we have to work in a non-Feed the Future country, ones that is not in the top 12, in order to get our science done properly, and we make that case, then we will be in maybe countries like Indonesia or South Africa or other countries that haven't made the list. But we have to build a case that in order to get the science done properly, so that we have work that the outcome is creates a global public good for whatever, pest control or climate resilience, then we have a better license to be in other countries.
Well,
better answer that because I fund AVRDC as well. So your concern is that there's duplication? Yeah, it's in Arusha.
AVRDC World Veg Center is a very important partner in our project. So yes, we're working very closely with them. And they have a new general director now, and we've been in communication with him about how we might expand some of our activities into some of their other target countries with our eye on what the new Feed the Future countries are. And so, yes, we have very tight work with them. And we're doing a lot of production research in these countries that they don't do. So I think it's a partnership that is going to move the pendulum forward quite dramatically.
But like this innovation lab doesn't do any real breeding. So we most of our funding to AVRDC goes to breeding and germplasm conservation and breeding for nutrition, breeding for post-harvest resilience, breeding for pest control, this kind of thing. And we'll continue to fund them into the future like we fund the International Ag Research Centers as an expertise center in world leader in breeding.
Just to build on this, you highlighted and John and Steve mentioned, in Burkina Faso, like, we are not working on the varieties which should be good for a particular rainy season. So that material, we are using it from the AVRDC who has done it, but as a part of the project, we have integrated it into the varietal adaptability and also convincing the farmers on those particular varieties which has already been developed. So it's not about reinventing the wheel, using the wheel to fasten it faster, make it faster for adoption. So that kind of approach is being done.
Well, there's lots of opportunities. One of the best opportunities, you know, and I have a lecture kind of on career opportunities in international agriculture, not specifically horticulture that I've given it. I gave one not too long ago at Louisiana State for students and young faculty. So, but it was general agriculture and not just horticulture. So, I mean, one of the best ways to get involved is, you know, first of all, as part of your PhD experience, or even if you can do it as part of your master's experience, is to get hooked up and to do some of your field research in a developing country, and that will immediately set you apart from any Tom, Dick, Jane, or Harry who gets a PhD and suddenly wants to go into international cold, all right? So you can get that kind of experience through fellowships, scholarships, through AID or through other donor agencies, through Fulbright. There's a whole list of, you know, possibilities. But then once you get your PhD and have some field experience in a developing country, then, I mean, a really good way, you know, I briefly mentioned that we fund these international agricultural research centers. There's the CGIAR system, but they don't really do too much in horticulture. The only one I mentioned was ICRAF, which Agroforestry World Center, which does some work on fruits. So you can look at the World Veg Center, generally really one, that and that's in Taiwan, and to get like a postdoc experience there is one way to start. If you're willing to, you know, you could, these other, if you're just restrict yourself to horticulture, you're kind of doing yourself a disservice. You can always hook back to horticulture later, but if there's a great opportunity at, you know, SEAD or something to work on, you know, tropical agroecosystems, or there's a great opportunity at CIMMYT to work on aspects of irrigation, you know, then you can follow that. And you can eventually, because at the end of the day, at AID or at World Bank or other donor organizations, we tend to hire, we want generalists, we want jack of all trades type people with years and years of experience. On our agricultural research team, somebody may join it and have a background in breeding, but we ask them to work, you know, with me on vegetable projects. Or someone comes in and they got a breeding background and they may be asked to support, you know, an aquaculture project because that's just the way it is. And that's AID in particular. You have to really become a multitasker. And, you know, I manage a program area that's everything from nutrition research to hort research to post-harvest research, aquaculture, livestock, post-harvest food processing. And I used to be a plant pathologist, and now I'm dealing with all this stuff. I'm a jack of all trades. I'm an expert at really nothing except international management projects, funding agents, you know, funding implementers like Davis and others too. I'm good and experienced at kind of oversight. I am pretty good at potatoes. I worked 12 years in the potato sector with different companies, and that's another way to get involved. Is if you're willing to get involved with multinational companies, many multinational companies, they need, you know, agricultural experts, whether they have a background in horticulture, aquaculture, or whatever. They know how to work in developing countries, and they've got some sort of a PhD, and because they're developing supply chains. Nestle's and Starbucks are developing coffee supply chains. McDonald's is developing potato supply chains. Cargill is looking at, you know, wheat and rice supply chains. And when you get, they don't necessarily look for rice specialists or veg specialists. They look for people who've got demonstrated experience to put farmers together to meet a company demand in difficult, challenging, adverse environments. So if you can get, there's all kinds of opportunities with private sector. Then there's the whole world of NGOs, like CARE, World Vision, Helen Keller, who work and essentially are contracted by people like agencies like USAID. And then there is the whole world of contracting, implementing partners we have that are called contractors. See my old friend Don Humpel there, who's a veteran at this. He's a unique combination of high levels of expertise in agronomy, but coupled with years and years of experience of applying that agronomy through AID projects and other kind of projects that are essentially technical assistance projects in many countries. And a lot of these projects are not really doing research, they're doing technical assistance. And this is how we do our work at AID, mainly through implementing partners like his firm, DAI. And these firms need to get on the roster of these firms, you need to get on their radar and into their computer databases, so at some point in time, you'll be called by them for a certain job, and then you can get a start. And then you get that start with a company that's implementing an AID project, and you do well on that, and then you just build a reputation of being able to successfully help that firm keep AID happy. And then you're kind of on your way. So, NGOs, contractors, direct work with USAID, multinational corporations, entry-level positions in the CG in international research centers. I could go on and on. So.
You have any questions there?
International Agricultural Development Graduate Group at UC Davis, and I think another skill set that's good to get is a project management and evaluation course or certificate. I don't know if you've done that, but you can get them online, but it's to sort of build up your skills also in the ability to work on projects. Very helpful.
The question seems to be if you're already in a nonprofit international organization,
yes.
Such as Well, the direct approach to AID usually doesn't work, because then you're talking about kind of like doing something that's essentially unsolicited by us. And we get approached by those kind of things by many different peoples, individuals, big organizations, small organizations all the time. And a lot of times we have to kind of be kind of, you know, cold and just kind of forget about it. So the best way is to connect kind of indirectly. So first of all, you have to know when AID proposals come out. You have to, you know, be able to go to grants.gov and see opportunities. Opportunities will be in the area of technical assistance, or they may be in research. There's a lot more money in technical assistance, and then you just have to kind of establish yourselves, and you have to, if you're a small fry, you have to then convince, you know, a medium fry or a large fry organization that has traditionally done a lot of work for USAID, like an implementing partner, to take you on. You have to network with big firms like DAI and Chemonix and Apt and these, and convince them that you're a partner that's worth working with. And then when they go after a big proposal, they may choose to include you or not. And then if you are included and that team wins the proposal, then you have start to build a track record. But direct approaching, you know, Rockefeller or AID or World Bank, and if you're just a small organization, even if you're a big organization, when it's unsolicited, it's very, very tough in the development world, because, you know, in our case, it's taxpayer money, and we have all kind of processes where we script out, you know, why we're doing, we have a whole strategy why we do this or that. And when somebody suddenly wants to do something really cool and interesting that's not part of our strategy, we can't really justify it. We're not like a university or something more flexible like Gates Foundation that can suddenly, oh, that sounds really cool, why don't you talk to me some more. And maybe AID, it's very scripted by we have, you know, 5-year strategic plans and this kind of thing that we have to adhere to.
So the question was triple burden on developing countries. I think as most of you are dealing with hunger and the hidden hunger and the obesity. So one time we're talking about just only hunger, Now it is a hidden hunger where there are no clear symptoms until the disease occurs. So then at the same time, the same developing country where there is a shortage of food, but they're also facing the same challenge of the obesity. That means they're not eating the right food. So those are three burdens which is going to be a challenge in the future. I'm sorry. El Nino effect. Okay, so that's basically a lot of the climate changes are happening with, like as you just saw the last 2 months, there are hurricanes and the earthquake. Of course, those are all disasters, causes a lot of the food security problems in the world. Yes, there was a question. That question goes to Kate, I think.
Yeah, you're wondering about how to get people up to speed who may not be so used to it in working on using participatory approaches rather than the sort of top-down approach of lecturing. That's not an easy... It's not an easy solution because it takes time to build relationships that allow that to sort of materialize, and it's not usually time and space that's created in big projects. I don't know how small your project is. You know, I mean, if there are people who have relationships with one another rather than someone roaring in and counting off their 100 farmers with their intervention and then going somewhere else. Is it more of a smaller... Yeah. There's some great resources about how to what are tools to be able to do participatory, which sometimes helps people to... like not be embarrassed and figure out how to do it, because we're very safe behind our podiums and standing up in front of the classrooms, because you don't know where things go often with the participatory approaches. But there are, like, FAO has a really good it's sort of gender-oriented climate change, but just an amazing manual for participatory approaches, both the theory and also a lot of exercises of what to do. So that's one place to go, is just go and use those and start to practice. And the other way is just keep people in small groups. And I can talk to you outside, because it's kind of hard to talk without knowing a lot about the process, but it's labor intensive, these types of approaches, right? They don't work for the giant, you know, big scale interventions, unless people are working on how to bring some of that into it. But you see the word participatory a lot in now floating around everywhere in development, so people feel they need to do something about it.
We have the last 8 minutes, so are there any burning questions from the audience? Yes. Go ahead.
This question is for Kate. Kate, you talked about 50-50 gender equity in Uganda. I was wondering if you have any suggestions on how to get that, because I was in Arua, Uganda, a couple of months ago, and men were talking. Men seem to get it only if there's a more powerful one.
So you can't get the men in? It's like 100% women in your groups? Is that what you're saying? Yeah. It's amazing what men do. Yeah.
So I was just wondering.
It's not Yeah, it's not exactly 50-50. You know, it's really more driven by it has to be at least 50% women. And then usually a lot of the groups are more than 50% women. There's one group where, like, the men put the women at the front. They say, these women figured out how to do it, and, you know, we don't need to butt in, you know, like, because they actually are really earning income and being really great for the group. So the men don't want part of that. But in other groups, there's, the men are definitely there. When you have the events and the farmer exchanges and things like that, suddenly there are the men at the front talking and describing things. So, you know, there's big variances among groups. But so we don't mind if we don't have 50% men, because... I think there has to be like a motivation for them to be involved. And I mean, in some of our groups, the women don't go to market. Like they don't move freely. I mean, there seems to be, control. They're not supposed to be moving around. And that's where men can come in. So particular kinds of activities like that might be where men come in. And also with with these big technology, we have stuff that has to go out in the field that women can't do, physically they can't do. So you have to have like the men engaged in that kind of thing. But I don't know what your context is, if that's helpful, but And why do you want the men in?
Because of the gender, we want to get men also involved in day-to-day operations.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy, yeah. Yeah, and also I think in the long run it's like keeps everybody feeling better if men are involved. Men don't like to be excluded. Women don't want the men excluded. Because in the long run, that will bite them back. So it is really important to do it. So I would focus on what are the aspects of what is going on that are more likely to engage men. Because it isn't like the men will want to start doing women's crops or whatever, right? I mean, however this language. But there's roles that they could play, and maybe it's focusing on those. Yeah. Or go ask them. Ask them why they're not there.
Yeah, when I
asked
them, they said the alcohol and money.
Oh. We have last 5 minutes left, so we are going to put some of the speakers on the spot now. So we would like the speakers who spoke up their topic and what they worked on the international countries, different countries, we'd like them to take about half a minute to tell about what they feel in future, in the coming 10 years. Out-of-the-box thinking, not what you're doing now, and what is the solution for that in a minute. So whoever wants to, it's not for everybody, but whoever wants to jump in, what is the coming 10-year solution, problems in the developing countries you are dealing with, and how do you solve it? But your answer and question has to be done in 1 minute. Yeah. Go ahead, come here.
So one of the two of the million-dollar questions, which I think everyone battling around, one is getting youth in agriculture. You go anywhere, everyone talks about it. And the second is access to finance. A lot of models has been looked at, but still when you really see the people who really need money to grow, and the word which is being widely used right now, and everyone talks scaling up. So I think the solution in that is which we have to all work towards getting the pride in agriculture, which I think somehow in the developing world that has been lost. And on the access to finance, we have to really look into some of the new models. Just a one-line example, last 10 days back in Nepal, we were working with small seed companies who were supposed to give money to the farmers as advance for seed production. And then we got the bankers involved and got them into the picture, and then they said, oh, we can finance these guys. And we could see that in a, it took time, but it's a $2 million freed from those small entrepreneurs, which can be used by them in breeding or building any infrastructure. So there are models which we all have to, as Doctor said, we have to look out of the box, and we'll be happy to be part of any of these challenges, because some of them, bringing youth in agriculture, I'm still struggling. So no answer.
Any other speakers? Quick.
I think we still have a lot of work to do to convince the development community that horticulture is something we need to invest in. There's been so little effort paid to horticulture in the past, but has so much to offer in terms of income generation and nutrition and opportunities for people, particularly women. So I think we have to keep pushing that in the future. And then I think the other thing I agree with Gil, I mean, the idea is going to be to, you know, the things that we find that work, how do we scale those out? How do we make that happen in many, many places for many, many more farmers?
Thank you. Sorry, I'm putting you in the spot for everybody.
Four-letter word, soil. So soil has to actually start to exist in people's consciousness. You know, irrigation is a lot about soil. Growing crops is a lot about soil, and soil's been incredibly degraded and continues to degrade, and it's a big challenge is the quality of soil in a lot of the tropical areas. And so what needs to happen, there's, it's certain practices that, you know, pay attention to the soil. Don't just farm the above ground, but farm the below ground. And I suppose one of the biggest issues is getting organic material back into soil. And that's where food wastes and different kinds of agricultural waste that are, you know, maybe not flowing back in is one place to target that. Because in most cases, going around and cow manure and vegetation, there's not enough. It's already all being used. The organic matter is already being used. So it's finding new sources of that.
Any other speakers?
Styrofoam.
A couple of problems I've been thinking for the past 2 years I've been working abroad is overpopulation and how we're going to be able to feed all these people that are, you know, the population of Asia and Africa is growing very, very fast, and I would say birth control and educating women and families generally and do a good family planning program. And another one is natural disasters and how they affect like farming and food production, and that's climate change, and it's a big problem. We can solve it as
horticulture. Thank you.
So I think we have only 2 minutes left. So my thought on that out-of-box thinking is, as we talked about, the topic of today was developing countries. But I think what we are missing is the graduate students, particularly in this country, are not aware of what's happening in the global level. So we just asked the course we developed, as I showed earlier, we asked a lot of students from Ohio, Texas A&M, Purdue. They didn't know there is a hunger exists in the United States. So we need to really educate people, and I think previous question about how do we involve in the international level, we need to educate people about what is international, because they should not think Texas is, like when you think about students in Texas, they think that California is an international country. That we need to start changing that thing in the United States to think about the global level. And with that, I think John wanted to say something.
I'll just put in a very quick plug for more work on food safety. Because we are pushing really hard now for, you know, on vegetables, on aquaculture, on livestock, and as we push hard in those areas to get our beneficiaries consuming more to accomplish our diet diversity goals, we're not taking care of the perishability aspects. If you don't take care of these highly perishable commodities with really good food safety practices, then the fish going bad, fecal contamination on horticulture, livestock products going bad, it gets really serious and you can really hurt people. So it's been a neglected area. The problem is it agriculture or is it health? Agriculture and health never work well together in terms of ministries, in terms of even within my own agency, global health Bureau working with Food Security Bureau is tough. So food safety, that's my contribution.
Okay, so we're out of time. The other group's coming in. I just wanted to say thank you to all the speakers.